loss is irreversible, results in cognitive dissonance that infiltrates multiple aspects of the survivor's life. The characters of The Walking Dead have little time to sit and reflect on their grief, and they lack access to the psychological care necessary to mitigate their maladaptive behaviors. Rick's phone calls with Lori may be the only relief he has in terms of his guilt. Over time, Rick and Carl both move on from their loss. The phone calls become less and less important to Rick, and Carl regains some of his personality. The two continue living their life, building and rebuilding the world around them. They find the will to survive. With time and distance from the trauma, they truly start to see that Lori and Judith's deaths were no fault of their own. Rick sums it up best in a later conversation with Andrea. Andrea, yeah, you can get caught up in dwelling on all the horrible things that have happened. It can slow you down, get you killed. Rick, exactly. So I just don't do it. I rarely stop and reflect on anything that's happened. Doesn't mean I don't miss Lori. I do. I just can't think about her too much, or it's... Rick has found a way to move on. Fast forward a few dozen issues, and we see Carl address Andrea as Mom. There is hope for those left behind. The hard truth of survivor's guilt is that the death of the survivor would not have protected the loved ones. Rick finding some way to sacrifice his own life would not have saved Lori and Judith. Tyrese killing Chris early on would not necessarily have protected his daughter. There is certainly no way Alan could trade places with Donna and let her live and take care of their sons. Maggie is left powerless as each family member dies until she becomes the last of the Greens. Despite this fact, the survivors live each day blaming themselves for living while another person is dead in the ground. The best step a survivor can take is to find a way to honor the memory of the fallen and continue surviving. Herschel's stages of grief. The psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross observed that many individuals undergo 5 stages of grief in coping with death and other losses. Farmer Herschel Green manifests them all. Stage 1. Denial. When Herschel's wife and neighbors become walkers, he refuses to believe they have died. However much denial may alleviate potentially crippling stress, it can blind people to genuine threats and raise the likelihood of their later developing PTSD. Stage 2. Anger. After Rick's group destroys the barn walkers, an enraged Herschel orders them off his property. On television, his anger is brief. In the comic books, he stays mad enough to send them away. Stage 3. Bargaining. A person may hope to undo or prevent the loss by means such as pleading to a higher power or seeking out different medical opinions. Herschel does this out of order. In conjunction with his denial, this devoutly religious man bargains to care for those people until a cure becomes available. Stage 4. Depression. After the barn walker's destruction in the comics, Herschel puts a gun to his head to take his own life until Rick stops him. On television, the recovered alcoholic Herschel goes drinking. Stage 5. Acceptance. Once Herschel moves past his depressive episode to face his new reality and learn to cope, he reveals himself to be a voice of wisdom. Kubler-Ross's stages do not apply to all people, especially in a post-apocalypse in which the world itself can make anyone feel terminally ill. Grief follows no set pattern, obeys no rules. T.L. 14. The Walking Traumatized. Janina Scarlett. Shane.
Jim, nobody's gonna hurt you, okay?
Jim.
That's a lie. That's the biggest lie there is. I told that to my wife and my 2 boys. I said it 100 times. It didn't matter. They came out of nowhere. There were dozens of them. Just pulled them out of my hands. You know, the only reason I got away was because the dead were too busy eating my family.
The Walking Dead provides a window into emotional trauma. The protagonist, Rick Grimes, seems especially traumatized by the events that follow the apocalypse. After Rick has to kill his best friend, Shane, his personality changes drastically. Once calm, friendly, and level-headed, Rick becomes controlling, suspicious, and angry. He grows distant from his wife, Lori. After she dies in childbirth, Rick has hallucinations, hearing the voices of people who have died since the outbreak, and then seeing his deceased wife haunt the prison. What's wrong with Rick? What does this mean for Rick? Does he have post-traumatic stress disorder? Does he have schizophrenia? Is his reaction normal? How does he get better? Does Rick have PTSD? Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, is a mental health disorder that can occur among a substantial minority of those who experience life-threatening trauma. The symptoms people with PTSD experience fall into these categories: intrusions, flashbacks, nightmares, or constant thoughts about the traumatic event. Rick's flashbacks dealing with Shane's death are an example of intrusions. Hyperarousal and change in mood. Being easily startled, overly vigilant, having trouble sleeping or relaxing, feeling angry and irritable, acting aggressively. When Rick first learns of Lori's death, he reacts by lashing out at the prison's walkers and anyone in his way, including Glenn. Avoidance. This is perhaps the biggest manifestation of PTSD. Symptoms typically include avoiding anything related to the traumatic event, including thoughts and feelings about the trauma, and reminders such as people, places, and conversations. After Lori dies, Rick stays away from his children and friends. Not until after he hallucinates a phone conversation with Lori, who reminds him of his duty to protect their children, does he hold his daughter for the first time. To be diagnosed with PTSD, a person must experience symptoms from these categories for at least a month. Although Rick's symptoms become most severe immediately after Lori's death, he already experienced most of them after killing Shane. He continues to show most of the PTSD features long after he stops hallucinating. When one considers all these symptoms together, it does seem likely that Rick has PTSD. Although hallucinations are not part of the PTSD diagnosis, research suggests that as many as 20% of people with PTSD are likely to develop some kind of psychosis, especially if they experience hyperarousal, as Rick does. Psychosis refers to a loss of reality in which a person may create false beliefs, delusions, or see, hear, or smell things that are not there, hallucinations. Rick experiences visual and auditory hallucinations when he sees Lori and speaks to her on the telephone. On the television show, his auditory hallucinations stop after he realizes he is hallucinating and says farewell to Lori. In the comic books, the phone conversations continue for a longer time, but eventually stop when his PTSD symptoms start to subside. This suggests that his hallucinations most likely were triggered by the traumatic loss, rather than by another condition, such as schizophrenia. Along with PTSD, a likely diagnosis for Rick might be brief psychotic disorder, which is characterized by the presence of one or more of the symptoms listed for schizophrenia, but lasts less than 1 month. This disorder often results from a major stressor or trauma, and this fits with what we know about Rick. PTSD beliefs. Research suggests that PTSD affects a number of different beliefs, especially those related to safety, trust, control, esteem, and intimacy. Safety beliefs relate to our ability to protect others or ourselves. Rick confides to the CDC scientist Jenner that he feels he may not be able to protect his family. Trust beliefs have to do with people's ability to trust themselves and others. When Tyrese and his friends ask to live in the prison, Rick refuses, shouting at them to leave. Control beliefs have to do with needing to be in control. Rick, Shane, and the governor push themselves to control situations and don't usually trust others to lead. Esteem beliefs relate to self-esteem as well as regard for other people. Rick blames himself for Lori's death and confides to Daryl that he has screwed up too many times. Intimacy-related beliefs have to do with our ability to get close to other people. Shane's death causes a rift in Rick and Lori's relationship. It is undoubtedly traumatic for them in different ways. When Lori tries to talk to Rick, he pushes her away. You want to talk? Talk to Herschel. I'm doing stuff, Lori. Things. What causes PTSD? Many people, approximately 60%, are exposed to traumatic events during their lives. Nearly all who are exposed to trauma initially may have some symptoms similar to those seen in PTSD, but most people get better. Approximately 4 to 10% of those exposed to trauma develop PTSD. Some of the most common reasons for developing PTSD have to do with how we feel, think, and act. After a traumatic event, a person may learn to associate certain cues in the environment with danger. For example, because Lori dies as an indirect result of the inmate Andrew's actions, Rick regards all strangers as dangerous to his group. He drives Tyrese's group away. Because he remembers Andrew, his automatic response becomes that of mistrust and defensiveness toward anyone outside the immediate crew. Occasionally he is right, of course, but there are also times when he isn't. Another cognitive, thinking-based cause of PTSD has to do with the way a person interprets the trauma. Those who blame themselves for traumatic events are more likely to feel guilt and shame about them, and this makes PTSD more likely. For example, Morgan, the first person to tell Rick about walkers and the apocalypse, later blames himself for his son's death. Even though Morgan is not directly responsible, he cannot bring himself to kill his walker-turned-wife, who later kills their son. The blame that he places on himself prevents him from mourning his son adequately. Mourning is a natural process after losing a loved one. If it is interrupted, a person can develop a mental illness. Morgan appears to be spiraling downward. He doesn't recognize Rick when he sees him again, mutters to himself, and writes strange notes no one can interpret. When forced to act against their moral code, people with strong moral values such as Morgan and Rick are very likely to feel guilty, possibly affecting their self-esteem and identity. This change is called moral injury. Rick, a county sheriff, often feels responsible for protecting others and is overall a moral and compassionate person. Even when he exterminates a walker, a woman crawling around in a park, he bends down to tell her, "I'm sorry this happened to you." However, between his old life ending, his son Carl getting shot, and his wife getting pregnant, Rick's goals shift from saving the world to protecting his family. As he tells Shane, "I'm not a good guy anymore. To protect Carl, I would do anything." Not until Rick kills Shane does he seem to experience the effects of moral injury. Specifically, Rick stops trusting his group, stating, "This isn't a democracy anymore." Feeling defensive, guilty, and angry about killing Shane, he pushes away those closest to him, including Lori. All these symptoms are consistent with moral injury, which can make a person more likely to be suspicious, distant, and prone to sabotaging his or her relationship with others. Moral injury, insufficient social support, and continuous exposure to violent trauma not only make it more likely that a person will develop PTSD, they make it less likely that that person will recover from it. Unlike the other characters, Rick awoke into the post-apocalyptic nightmare. Nearly dying from a gunshot wound can traumatize even the most resilient people. Subsequently, waking from his coma alone in an abandoned hospital, starved and dehydrated, and then discovering dead people's remains, both inanimate and reanimated, might push anyone over the edge, and the stresses keep piling up. Learning that the outbreak affects the entire world, nearly losing his son to a gunshot wound, killing his best friend, repeatedly losing members of his group, and losing his wife, all form a perfect combination of continuous, mind-boggling traumas that finally knock Rick off his feet, causing a mental breakdown. After Lori dies, Rick goes on a rampage, slaying walkers throughout the prison. In the process, he becomes covered in blood and guts, looking a bit like a walker himself. After all his painful losses, Rick is not the same optimistic person he once was. He sometimes loses hope that things will ever improve again, and he is not the only one. Beth Green, after the extermination of the Walkers in her family's barn, including her mother, and Abraham, after losing his entire family, attempt suicide at different times. Others, including Jackie and Jenner at the CDC, do take their own lives, believing that there is no hope left. Hopelessness is one of the biggest factors in why a person may commit suicide, especially when it relates to all three of the following aspects. Negative view about oneself, having to do with the person's own negative judgments. For example, Abraham might have thought, "I'm a failure as a husband and father." Negative view about the world, through evaluations of other people. For example, when Father Gabriel says, "Nowadays, people are just as dangerous as the dead." And negative view about the future. For example, Jenner saying, "There is no hope. There never was." Because hopelessness is such a painful emotion, the sufferers often look for ways not to experience it. Experiential avoidance is the unwillingness to experience the painful thoughts, feelings, or other sensations that may occur when an individual is going through a hard time and is looking for a way to avoid experiencing these painful sensations. Paradoxically, trying to avoid painful emotions actually could make people feel worse. It may make them more likely to want to commit suicide. Bob's drinking and Merle's drug use are examples of experiential avoidance. In the short term, experiential avoidance can temporarily mask or reduce physical or emotional pain. In the long term, though, it can make the pain worse, because avoidance supports the idea that the situation is hopeless. Avoiding problems instead of facing and working on them often can cause or worsen PTSD, depression, panic, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and other mental health disorders. What does The Walking Dead teach about survival? Rick, Abraham, and Beth, like other apocalypse survivors, have been through some of the most horrific traumas and all attempt suicide at various points in their lives. Each finds a reason to live and changes drastically in order to stay alive. What do the three of them have in common? How do they manage to overcome their fears and hopelessness? What keeps them alive for as long as possible? They each find a purpose. After Walkers eat his family, Abraham is ready to commit suicide before Eugene runs toward him, asking for help. Abraham saves Eugene's life, and then Eugene saves Abraham's by offering him a secret mission. This gives Abraham a reason to live. He is a soldier. Being needed, being responsible for the lives of others, and having a specific goal are exactly what he needs to regain hope and fight to stay alive. For most service members, belief in the importance of their mission can reduce the likelihood of developing PTSD. Like Abraham, many people struggling with depression, overwhelming anxiety, or PTSD can recover faster if they stay true to their values. Values, different categories of areas that are important to a specific person, can include family, friends, compassion, altruism, health, spirituality, and many others. When people stay true to their values and act in ways consistent with them, they are more likely to recover from mental illness. Beth loses hope after Shane and others execute all of her Walker family and friends who were kept in a barn. She concludes, "It's just so pointless." Terrified that she will be gutted and unable to cope, she begs her older sister Maggie to die with her. Not until she actually attempts to kill herself does she realize that she wants to stay alive. What arguably changes Beth's outlook on life the most occurs when Daryl later tells her that she will be responsible for taking care of Rick and Lori's newborn child. She finds purpose and follows her value of taking care of others. Another value that helps people recover from depression and trauma is compassion, recognizing that another person is suffering, being able to empathize with that person, to put yourself in their shoes, and being able to offer kindness. Daryl Dixon provides a great example of how someone can heal through compassion. Daryl survived severe childhood abuse and neglect, which left him angry and mistrusting. He and his brother Merle are even planning to rob the rest of the crew before Rick arrives at the campsite. Over time, Daryl begins to connect with others, starting with Carol when her daughter Sophia goes missing. Tirelessly looking for Sophia, Daryl performs the ultimate act of compassion when, recognizing that Carol is in great emotional pain, he brings her a Cherokee rose, a Native American sign of strength and hope for the mothers of lost children. It is through compassion, social support, and staying true to his values that Daryl is able to heal the scars of his turbulent past, and Rick, Beth, and Abraham are able to face their new experiences. Ultimately, opening up to painful experiences and being true to our core values and to ourselves seem to be the key ingredients in overcoming trauma.
15. Eros, Thanatos, and an Armory of Defense Mechanisms. Sigmund Freud in the Land of the Dead. Travis Langley. Fear of the dead is so strong within us and always ready to come to the surface at any opportunity. Most likely our fear still contains the old belief that the deceased becomes the enemy of his survivor. Psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud, 1856 to 1939, had plenty to say about sex and death, especially sex. This famous and infamous psychiatrist, who saw sex as life and therefore the greatest force driving our progress as people, described defenses we use to feel better about ourselves. He believed that these defenses help us persist throughout the journey between birth and death. Instinctively, inherently, Freud felt, we know in our bones that the end must come, even though we do not completely believe it. To keep going, we find ways to cope, even though that sometimes entails playing tricks on ourselves. Instincts. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. However much life and death may cycle back and forth, at our beginning and end both await inanimate states with life as the disturbance, the chaos in between. Life is fire between ashes and ashes. We fuel the flame. We burn to cope, to defend, to enjoy, to live better and longer, to fight death however we can. Because wildfire can spread beyond its burned-out source, we create and procreate as ways to blaze beyond our own lifespans. When The Walking Dead characters Laurie and Shane have sex, they feel alive. Coupling helps Maggie and Glenn, Abraham and Rosita, and others escape the horror of living in a world overrun by ravenous reanimated corpses. Actors Michael Cudlitz and Christian Serratos both said that their characters, Abraham and Rosita, realizing death can strike at any turn, would not be the only ones to seize the moment in their post-apocalyptic world and have sex often. Others, though, may be wary of celebrating life even briefly, perhaps because getting close can make the pain of inevitable loss hurt even more. An example is Daryl Dixon, the rugged redneck hero who keeps hesitating in areas of intimacy. A great proportion of Freud's psychodynamic theory considers how our need to keep ourselves and our species alive may motivate us. A need driven by the life instinct, or instincts, he sometimes collectively called Eros, after the Greek god of erotic love. Even though he had resisted Alfred Adler's suggestion that people also have an aggressive drive deriving from a death instinct, Freud later hypothesized the existence of the death instinct, or instincts, his colleague Wilhelm Steckel would dub Thanatos. Whereas Adler meant it more like a drive to assert oneself, Freud speculated about its being more destructive. Because we know death is inevitable, and life is the struggle against it, Freud felt, we sometimes give up the struggle and give in to death or destruction. In the unconscious, every one of us is convinced of our own immortality. Sigmund Freud. Along the way, how do we keep from giving up? According to Freud, our instincts drive us toward both life and death, whereas our minds, both conscious and unconscious, resist accepting death. How does someone who gives up at one point, such as The Walking Dead character Beth, who attempts suicide on TV, or her sister Maggie, who attempts it in the comics, find renewed reasons to live? In our mental repertoire, fortunately, We have a whole armory of weapons and shields, the defenses with which we protect ourselves from internal conflicts and from our feelings about external reality. Ego defense mechanisms. Although the life and death instincts fall into that untestable area of Freudian theory that many criticize and reject as unscientific, the defense mechanisms take us into an area where Freud receives some of his highest praise. Even if we don't always do these things for the reasons he assumed, we do go to great lengths to cope with life's stresses. We all lie to ourselves, sometimes. Defense mechanisms involve self-deception and other techniques for relieving stress and anxiety, reducing emotional conflicts, and protecting self-esteem, generally without our realizing that that is why we do these things. His daughter, Anna Freud, cataloged the defense mechanisms he described. She named most of them and identified more. The Freuds and Neo-Freudians view these as unconscious safeguards against stressors. Later investigators identified additional defenses. The psychiatrist George Valiant categorized them as mature, neurotic, immature, and psychotic, in accordance with the way they correspond with healthy psychological development. We all do some of these things, whether we realize it or not. I don't know why I do the things I do. Never did. I'm a damn mystery to me. Merle Dixon. Healthy, mature defenses. People need ways to manage stress and anxiety. In addition to conscious coping activities, such as thought suppression, deliberately trying not to think about something unpleasant or distracting, such as how badly your friend hurts while you need to aim at oncoming zombies, Freudians say that we cope in other ways unconsciously, without realizing it. Even when we know we're doing these things, we supposedly don't know we're doing them to protect our emotions and self-esteem. The more mature defenses tend to be practical. Anticipation involves foreseeing difficulties and planning accordingly. Once the protagonist Rick Grimes and his group dispatch walkers in a prison yard, some characters want to rest, but Rick prefers to plan ahead and prepare for potential problems in this new environment, to turn the prison into their own fortress. Affiliation, forming relationships with others, offers safety in numbers and security as part of a group even when people must keep relocating. Surviving together is all that matters, Rick eventually decides. Instead of acting on unacceptable impulses, a person may sublimate that mental energy, directing it into creativity or any other activity. This occurs when Rick takes up farming on the prison grounds as an alternative to violence. Humor helps us face life's worst without breaking down. Many TWD characters have good senses of humor, even if laughing sometimes feels wrong. After chuckling at Morgan's remark, Rick turns his smile down. After everything I've seen today, I feel guilty for laughing, he says. But Morgan reassures him, you can't let it get to you. You just gotta keep going. Daryl wisecracks. Merle mocks everyone. Father Gabriel amuses himself even though his jokes often rub others the wrong way. Michonne says that toddlers find her funny. And after hearing bad news about Eugene's mission to save the world, Tara starts making jokes instead of letting the sudden lack of a goal tear her down. Helping others through mercy, tolerance, acceptance, gratitude, or respect can emotionally fortify the person who helps. Altruism involves helping others without expectation of reward. Abraham Ford offers canned food to Glenn and Tara when they are about to part ways, even though at this point he expects never to see them again. After weeks of wanting to kill his girlfriend's murderer, only to discover that one of his own friends euthanized her, Tyrese shakes with anger, gripping a revolver, then abruptly stops and says, I forgive you. Forgiveness has not made him forget what has happened, but granting mercy helps take a great weight off him. Even these healthier defenses can reach maladaptive extremes. Using humor instead of sharing real feelings can keep a person from achieving intimacy. Excessive anticipation, obsessively overthinking instead of straightforwardly planning, can create stress, expend energy, and waste time. Granting mercy can come back to haunt the granter if its recipient later harms others. Cannibals might not have eaten Bob's leg if Tyrese had killed one when he had the chance. Thought suppression. Fans have wondered why, after losing to prison, Maggie doesn't talk about her sister at a time when she doesn't know if Beth is alive or dead. Even though she does not believe her sister is alive, Maggie does not have to think of Beth as dead either, and therefore herself as the last living Green, if she simply does not think about Beth. Neurotic defenses. Freud used the term neurosis for behavior that was mentally unhealthy, without broadly breaking from reality. He considered neuroses to be manifestations of unconscious processes that involve using defense mechanisms either too little or too much. He felt that we are all neurotic to varying degrees. Neurosis is not a modern diagnostic term, partly because of controversy regarding Freud's assumptions about unconscious causes, yet the word neurotic remains popular with the general public. Regardless of the underlying mechanisms, people do these things. Whereas the mature defenses involve finding ways to avoid acting on unhealthy impulses, several neurotic defenses involve creating ways to pursue them. Through displacement, a person acts out an impulse by directing it toward a target that seems safer. For example, snapping at a coworker when you're really mad at your boss. Upset over his girlfriend's murder, Tyrese punches Rick. Hospital director Officer Dawn strikes Beth, scarring her face over nothing Beth did. Irrational as lying to yourself may seem, rationalization means making rational feeling excuses so that you can do the things you want to do. Even though Dr. Stephen Edwards rationalizes staying at Dawn's hospital by blaming the walkers on the first floor, he does not leave when Rick offers him the chance. Through reaction formation, a less healthy way to sublimate, a person follows the impulse in a paradoxical way. The person redirects energy into the opposite of what's desired, such as campaigning against pornography as a way of wrestling with a porn obsession. Afraid, reluctant to admit how desperately he needs his father, Carl shouts angrily that he doesn't need him at all, although soon enough the boy admits he's simply scared. Other neurotic defenses involve distracting oneself instead of handling things maturely. Facing possible slaughter by cannibals, Eugene gets matter-of-factly analytical about dismantling a lock, intellectualization, until he is told to shut up. Characters repeatedly show examples of isolation, separating feelings from ideas and events. Teenager Beth Green takes in the news of her boyfriend's death with no emotional display. I don't cry anymore. Rick, Daryl, Michonne, Beth, and more, one character after another grows distant, removing himself or herself from everyone else in a process of withdrawal. With dissociation, for disassociation, different parts of the mind function simultaneously but separately. A simple example is highway hypnosis, when part of you daydreams while another part drives, until you may realize you don't remember the last several miles. In a world of survival horror, many characters dissociate to shield their best parts from the dark sides they sometimes unleash. Immature defenses. A child, who has yet to learn so many of life's most basic lessons, manages stress in ways that may be normal for a child, but inappropriate in adults. As part of the growing process, we adopt behaviors, values, and traits from others through identification with them. As a boy, Carl wears his father's deputy hat as a symbol of his identification with the heroic man his father was, before the zombie apocalypse began. Emulating a specific admired figure to the point that doing so changes who you are is unusual in adults, whose personalities have grown more stable and complex. Other immature defenses involve finding ways to avoid reality rather than face it. Instead of confronting a tormentor directly, a person may express aggression indirectly or passively. Passive aggression, through means such as procrastination. Rather than face the tyrannical officer Dawn directly, hospital residents bolster their self-esteem by means that include withholding information from her. Although fantasy, escaping into daydreams and other imaginings, but without mistaking them for reality, can help us dream up solutions or simply get away from problems for a while. Infantile fantasy keeps a person from dealing with real issues. Michonne converses with people who are long dead because doing so helps her think. Not suffering from delusions, she knows they're gone and does not believe they are present and answering her no matter how vividly she imagines them. The comfort of fantasy, though, detaches Michonne from her living companions and hinders relationship growth. Projection involves perceiving one's own undesirable qualities in others. For example, when the inveterately deceitful governor rejects Rick's peace offer by whispering, "Liar." When Father Gabriel warns Alexandria's leader that Rick's people will betray others to protect themselves, the guilt-driven Gabriel is projecting his feelings about himself onto them. These behaviors, which are normal enough in children, can seem childish in adults. They lessen immediate distress, but create problems, interfering with a person's ability to cope effectively with real life. Regression. Upset over the destruction of zombified family and neighbors he'd hoped could be cured, the recovered alcoholic Herschel goes binge drinking. A case of regression, immaturely reverting to old habits during stress, as if to carry the person back to more familiar times. Pathological defenses. Rearranging reality in one's head can take irrationality to a dangerous extreme. Denial involves refusing to acknowledge an unpleasant truth. She's not dead. Splitting simplifies life excessively by dichotomizing everything into all-or-nothing categories, for example, by seeing people as all good or all bad with no middle ground. One minute the Claimers' leader, Joe, counts Daryl among his companions, but then Daryl stands up for Rick, whom Joe intends to kill. Joe instantly decides that the Claimers should beat Daryl to death. Freud's term for any condition involving seriously losing touch with reality, psychosis, remains a standard psychiatric term even among non-Freudians. Though schizophrenias, dementias, and other long-lasting psychotic conditions often involve genetic, neurological, or other physical causes beyond their sufferer's control, some people with none of these disorders react to crisis, perhaps briefly, by losing their minds in a psychotic episode. After Lori Grimes dies, her husband, Rick, starts having hallucinations, perceptual experiences not reflecting real input to the physical senses. He has phone conversations with a voice only he hears. After the voice identifies itself as Lori, he understands that it is not real, and so he does not linger in a state of delusion, a belief grossly out of touch with reality. Yet he keeps hallucinating Lori. Hallucinations comfort him until he can, in time, move onward without them. When a wounded, weary, and addled Daryl Dixon hallucinates seeing his brother, Merle, in a forest, however, Daryl's injury-induced hallucination is more akin to a waking dream, daytime parahypnagogia, than to an unconscious attempt to escape from reality. It may, in fact, save his life by making him wake up enough to fend off walkers, and then keep moving through the woods. Feeling betrayed, rejected, and patronized by the living, the comic book version of Carol commits suicide by Walker, letting one bite her. Even though she talks to the Walker, sounding delusional by saying that she hopes it likes her. A sane person can speak conversationally to a pet, plant, picture, or toy without misunderstanding what is going on. Carol comprehends well enough to tell Tyrese in her final moment, "Just let me die." Her daughter, Sophia, in contrast, reacts to this loss by escaping another way, entering a catatonic state in which she sits staring blankly, unresponsive for days until the governor attacks the prison. The television character Beth Green similarly falls into some kind of catatonic shock, as Lori calls it, after witnessing her zombified mother's extermination. Life and death, a contrary balance. We live, we die, and we know it. The characters in The Walking Dead, much like people who live in war zones, concentration camps, hostile climates, and the rest of the worst this world has to offer, stay more aware of the death and danger in order to stay alive and lessen the danger. For some, Misapplying coping behaviors instead of facing cruel reality can prove deadly. For others, though, the reactions our distant ancestors developed during harsher parts of history can help them survive. Instead of causing problems such as anxiety disorders, when activated and misapplied in a world that lacks the kinds of threats those ancestors faced, our defense mechanisms can help us fight the fear. They can keep us alive longer and keep our species going. 16. Everybody knows their jobs, roles, systems, and the survivor group in your head. Adam Davis. Glenn, you be my wingman. Jackie stays here. Something happens, yell down to us. Get us back up here in a hurry. Jackie? Okay. Rick? Okay, everybody knows their jobs. After the dead rise and civilization falls, survival for individuals depends not only on skills and knowledge, but also on the group in which they find themselves. A lone person may be able to overcome one or two of the many challenges. For example, finding supplies, fending off walkers, defending against rival survivors. But rare is the survivor who excels at all the skills necessary to make it through a typical day in the world of the walking dead. Roles in a group. A survivor needs to join others whose skills complement his or her own. According to the character Abraham Ford, each must find some strong, like-minded comrades, and you stay stuck together like wet on water. We need people. The more, the better. Even as skilled as the protagonist, Rick Grimes, may be, without a group of fellow survivors working together to achieve their common goals, his chances of survival would be slim. Groups of survivors are not all the same, of course, and joining the right people can make a difference between life and death. A successful group needs people who adequately fill diverse roles to respond to volatile circumstances. Ready to explore escape options, Glenn assigns jobs to his fellow survivors. He assigns Rick and Andrea defensive roles, himself the task of running through the sewer, Morales assistance to Glenn, and Jackie lookout duties. He bases the assignments on their known strengths and abilities. For example, although Jackie may seem underutilized as a lookout, her knowledge as a city zoning office worker plays a critical role in forming the plan of using the sewer to escape. In this case, the group has enough individuals to address the circumstances, though the members do not know whether they all have the qualities necessary to succeed. Andrea is tasked with defending the storefront beside Rick, even though she knows little about guns, as demonstrated by the fact that Rick must remind her to turn off her gun safety so that she can fire it. She may be the best person available, but is hardly the ideal candidate. Ideally, survivor group members can shift flexibly between multiple roles. The drama therapist Robert Landy notes that psychological health depends on both how many roles a person has in life, for example, planner, protector, provider, father, friend, and how adequately that person can play those roles. When a drama therapist who uses Landy's role method meets a client, the therapist often analyzes the client's role repertoire. Some clients have a limited access to roles, as when Carl wants to perform more mature tasks than the adults permit. Some have inappropriate role selection, possibly when Rick farms while people need him in other roles. And others have roles that are underdeveloped. In families, members play more than one role. A mother does not play only the mother role, but also may play cook, cleaner, breadwinner, and more. Rick often plays the role of leader in his survivor group, and in his family he plays the roles of father and husband. Before Rick leaves the hospital and rejoins his family, though, Shane plays a surrogate father role for Carl, a partner role for Lori, and a leader role in their survivor group. When Rick joins the group, Shane does not shift his roles to make room for Rick's return. An overlap in group roles brings conflict that culminates in Shane's death. Role flexibility is essential for a successful survivor group, with roles shifting as the needs of the group change. Members leave or die, and new situations arise. Roles in a family, as in a survivor group, can be official or unofficial. Although the group generally recognizes Rick as its official leader, Daryl as its hunter, and Dale as its mechanic, the members also play unofficial roles. Dale, like Herschel later, fills the role of the wise old man, giving advice and reminding the group members of their humanity. The children, who may officially play the role of dependents who need to be taken care of by the adults, unofficially serve as symbols of hope, reminders of why the group should keep fighting to survive. In poorly functioning families and survivor groups, a leader who is inflexible, role rigidity, and has an inflated view of himself or herself, role exaggeration, can become the despotic governor, pushing those in the follower roles into either subjugation or rebellion. This power imbalance divides rather than unifies. Divided groups risk reduced morale or even mutiny. When one person overfunctions in a role, another person reciprocally underfunctions to create balance. If Rick plays the role of protective father to an extreme, Carl may become trapped in the reciprocal role of defenseless child as he grows into adolescence. If he never receives opportunities to develop new roles, he will not learn the valuable skills of using a weapon and defending himself, thus limiting the group's ability to be self-sustaining and adaptable for the future. Although individual qualities are important in selecting the members of a survivor group, they may not matter if a survivor cannot form collaborative relationships with others. On an Atlanta rooftop, T-Dog watches Merle Dixon, whom Rick has handcuffed. In some ways, Merle might seem ideal for a survivor group as a skilled tracker, hunter, and soldier who is able to defend the group from walkers and rival survivors alike. Unfortunately, his inability to collaborate, his impulsiveness, and his offensive personality make him an unpredictable ally at best, and a traitor in waiting at worst. A successful group of survivors is more than just a collection of talented individual role players. The members also must possess qualities that enable them to collaborate with the group's other members. Survivor group as survivor system. A term that family therapists use for a group of individuals is a system. In a system, the sum is greater than the parts. Just as individual atoms combine to create something more than they are individually, a group of individuals sharing genetic qualities become a family system, and the survivors in The Walking Dead become a survivor system. Historically, therapists focused on events in their clients' past that have caused undesirable thoughts and behaviors in the present that prevent them from living the lives they want. If Milton, the Woodbury researcher working under the governor in the television series, got to speak to a therapist, he might complain about his feelings of inadequacy. A traditional individual-focused therapist might work to improve Milton's self-image through positive self-talk, or by looking at Milton's upbringing to find a cause for his poor self-image. This therapist may view causality as linear. Something in the past caused the current situation, and a client's task is to move forward. A therapist considering systems, however, considers causality to be circular. A pattern of repeated interactions is occurring, reinforcing the presenting problem for the client. A systems therapist would look at Milton's ongoing relationships and the repeated social patterns in his life that could be perpetuating the problem. Any fan of the show could immediately point to Milton's relationships with the governor and Murrow as ongoing sources of the researcher's negative self-image. Milton behaves timidly around the governor, who then acts aggressively toward him, which causes Milton to behave more nervously, which prompts Merle's disparaging comments. The ongoing cycle does not have a clear beginning and end, because each component in the system reinforces the others. Milton's systems-oriented therapist may attempt to break the unhealthy cycle in his relationships before working on his personal development. In a closed system, the internal mechanisms that constitute the whole do not interact with anything outside the system. An example of a closed system would be a sealed greenhouse or a thermos. Nothing enters or leaves the system. Survivors who avoid outsiders and will not admit new members are attempting to create their own closed system. Open systems, in contrast, mutually engage with the environment around them. Most human systems are open. Humans breathe, eat, and reproduce. Families interact with other members of the community, and countries trade and wage war. Survivor systems take in materials from the environment, as well as knowledge and sometimes new members. Rick's group assimilates the survivor group at the Green Farm, forming new relationships and developing a new status quo. Being an open survivor system has its risks. A successful survivor system needs to judge, one, when to be open to new opportunities and resources, and two, when to stay closed to preserve its safety. When Herschel, Rick, and Glenn venture into town to Hatlin's Bar, they run into Dave and Tony. And though those outsiders try to discuss merging groups and sharing resources, Rick determines that keeping the group closed is the more intelligent option. The resulting shootout with Dave and Tony's group validates his choice. The original system of survivors in Atlanta contains family subsystems, which contain generational subsystems as well. Rick and Lori are the parental subsystem within the Grimes family system, which is inside the Atlanta Survivor Camp system. Zooming out, groups of survivors function with one another in a systemic way as well, interacting in cyclical patterned relationships. Systems and subsystems are surrounded by boundaries. A boundary is an invisible barrier, ranging from rigid to diffuse, that insulates one part of the system from another. In families, the type of parental boundary impacts the development of a child, and in a group of survivors, the boundaries around individual families and relationships affect the larger group. The abusive relationship between Ed and Carol Peltier, for example, is not insulated within their marital system, but spills over to affect the Peltier family system and the larger survivor system negatively. When Ed treats Carol abusively by the water where Andrea, Amy, Carol, and Jackie are washing clothes, Carol is not the only one who reacts. Andrea and Shane both respond to Ed's abuse, exacerbating the situation. Once a group of survivors develop routines and patterns of behavior, they may be hesitant to change them, especially if they seem to be working. Traditional systems theorists say that systems are naturally resistant to change, and that once patterns develop, the system naturally maintains the status quo. This is known as homeostasis. Homeostasis does not necessarily mean that the system is functioning optimally, simply that behavior has been repeated until it has become the norm. An overbearing father and a rebellious teenager may be in family therapy because the family system is perpetuating conflict instead of providing a safe and supportive atmosphere. The current homeostasis is conflict, and the family therapist will work to modify the system to establish a new homeostasis. In the context of a group of survivors, the ideal balance the system seeks to maintain is the sufficient collection of provisions for the group, and the successful defense against walkers and rival survivors. Groups can achieve this homeostasis in various ways, a concept known as equifinality. Rick's group achieves survival homeostasis at different times by building security systems and raising crops, as opposed to the survivors at Woodbury, who rely on raids of other survivor groups, and those at Terminus, who achieve homeostasis by attracting wanderers as a source of food. Though their tactics differ, the end results are similar. Survivor systems have a narrow margin of error. If they make one mistake, like when Father Gabriel fails to lock Alexandria's gate, everyone in the group could die, and so they must be receptive to continuous feedback and adjust the group accordingly. Because causality is circular and behavior patterns are repeated in a system, feedback takes the form of feedback loops that signal either that the system is on track and should continue functioning in the same manner, or that it must adjust to correct for deviation. When walkers attack the gate at the prison, for example, the inhabitants proceed to eliminate them by striking them with weapons through the fence. No members of the system become casualties, and so the structure of the system and the behavior of its inhabitants are reinforced. Reinforcements that encourage behavior are known as positive feedback loops. Although positive feedback loops provide valuable information to the system, they can cause problems if they recur unchecked. For example, the positive feedback loop at the prison gives the survivors an exaggerated sense of security, leaving them unprepared for attacks by walkers and the governor's forces from Woodbury. Their unpreparedness then results in multiple deaths and lost resources. The error-correcting mechanism in a system is a negative feedback loop. When a system receives negative feedback, it must regulate behavior and structure to re-establish a balance. The survivors adjust their system after the attacks by reinforcing the gates with wooden spikes, strengthening the perimeter fence, and reducing their reliance on the outside world by improving their internal ability to harvest food. Open human systems interact with the environments in complex ways. They are adaptive and self-aware. Successful survivor systems not only react to the environmental circumstances to perpetuate homeostasis, but are self-aware. They predict, plan, and consciously change structure and behavior to improve their chances of survival. For optimal chances in a zombie apocalypse, a survivor system must have role diversity. Adequacy in performing roles, qualities that enable the members to form complementary relationships within the system, and receptiveness to systemic feedback. These conditions for group success within the circumstances of The Walking Dead are also useful as a framework for understanding individual success in everyday life. Each individual has the potential to play many roles. Choose which role to play at each moment on the basis of the requirements of the specific situation, and receive feedback that is based on successes and failures of the role selection. Certain situations are better suited for Rick, some for Dale, and some for Shane, Merle, or even the governor. Cognitive dissonance. Lily remembers a shrink in Marietta once telling her this $3 phrase for the games a person's mind plays on itself when faced with two or three conflicting ideas. Dissonance, the opposite of harmony, unnerves us. Cognitive dissonance is discomfort over inconsistencies within ourselves. When we realize that our cognitions, like the inner part of Lily, Andrea, or Tara that recognizes the governor's evil, are inconsistent with our actions, all the ways in which they go along with him. People often change their beliefs to make them match actions they've already taken. Placed into different roles, whether by Glenn, the governor, or a Monroe, people can magnify their best or worst inner qualities to feel more consistent in their outward behavior. Many people follow the governor not because they believe him. Instead, some, such as Lily and Andrea, believe him because they followed him. TL. The survivor group in your head. Multiplicity, the idea that an individual's psyche is composed of distinct parts, is well rooted in psychology, although from a variety of sometimes conflicting perspectives. Freud, for example, posited that the psyche is composed of the id, ego, and superego, but others disagree. Some models of psychology go a step further, and instead of simply seeing the parts of the psyche as separate and distinct, conceptualize these individual parts as distinct inner personalities, functioning in systemic relationships with one another. Richard Schwartz developed internal family systems therapy in response to hearing his clients refer to their internal parts as being in conflict with one another. One part of them might want to drink excessively, while another part wants to remain sober. He cultivated the understanding that the parts could be considered as independent personalities within the individual, forming relationships and patterns of interaction analogous to a system of family members. Whereas Schwartz used the model of a family to describe internal systemic functioning, the model of a survivor system also serves as a useful model of a successfully functioning psyche. Imagine that everyone's individual psychological system is composed of independent personalities that function archetypically, in a similar fashion to that of the characters in The Walking Dead. In every living person's mind are the roles of protective sheriff, innocent child, wise old man, nurturing mother, stoic Michonne, impulsive Merle, even the controlling governor. As Schwartz makes sure to note with regard to an internal family system, each sub-personality has the goal of protecting the individual. None of them are truly destructive, even the ones that perpetually seem to sow chaos. They are, in one way or another, trying to protect the individual. In an internal survivor system, each sub-personality has the same goal. All the survivors, portrayed on The Walking Dead, seek to protect themselves from the dangers of the post-apocalyptic world, in one way or another. Individuals must learn to understand their internal survivor system. Seek to identify whether their inner Glenn or Rick would be the best role for a particular situation, and recognize that when their inner Merle or Governor arises, even though their methods are questionable, their goal